I was so happy to see so many other people who had been here having written books, because they know whereof I speak, you know, what it's like to get an envelope with a book you have written and slaved over, as Lars said, gambled over, put everything into, and you walk it into your house and you rip open the envelope and you go, wow, yes, my book. See, courage to write. That's my name, Ralph Kais. And then you go, feels kind of light. And then you go, oh my God, couldn't they have picked a better author picture? And then you start to read, and you see that on page 17 you said does when you meant to say did. And then you see that on page 27 and page 28 you used the phrase impossible dream 3 times in 1 paragraph. And on page 81 you have George Orwell using the term egotism when in fact he actually used the English form egoism. And you go, oh my God. What ever made me think I could write a book? But I did. It's out there. I live with it. This is what I've done for, gosh, 34 years now. That's all I've done is write magazine articles and books. People sometimes ask me what a writer needs most, a full-time writer, and I say a spouse with a good job. I wish Muriel were here now. She's our cash flow, and boy, does that come in handy, along with our health benefits. But it is all I've ever done. A friend of mine once quit her job at an insurance company. She was a vice president. She's a psychologist. And she called me up after a week because she was decided to be a freelance writer like me. And so she called me up and she said, Ralph, you've been writing for a long time, right? And I said, a few years. She said, well, I have a very important question to ask you. And I said, what's that, Laura? She said, when you get up in the morning, do you get dressed or what? And I said, Laura, what a question. I said, yes, as a matter of fact, I do get dressed. In fact, I'm dressed even as we speak. She said, well, I can't figure out any good reason to get dressed. Well, it turns out this was a very interesting question she had asked me. I started asking colleagues, do you dress to write? Well, it turns out it's very controversial. It turns out there are two schools of thought. You know, one school, I call one school the bathrobe school. You know, why dress? Who's going to see you? You know, hey, at most just put on a bathrobe. If it's hot, put on nothing. Type away. But there's another school of thought, which I belong to, which says, this is the dress to write school. My feeling is if you're going to work like a grown-up, you have to sort of more or less look like a grown-up. And as one writer friend of mine who I queried said to me, well, do I dress right? Geez, what, of course I do. I said, why? She said, well, actually, I lied. I don't dress. And I said, okay, tell me why you don't. She said, well, okay, if I were to get dressed, I could walk the dog, couldn't I? Or I could go to the grocery for a quart of milk. Or, oh, look, there's some clothes that need cleaning. She said, how am I going to get any work done if I get dressed? So it's very interesting, the different approaches. I did some reading on this topic, and it turns out John McPhee, you know, you've heard of John McPhee, the writer. Early in his career, he would only dress in a bathrobe, but he would tie the straps of the bathrobe to the arms of his chair. See, very tactical. Writers are tactical people. They have all these little gimmicks, you know, keep writing. Gay Talese, you've heard of him. He will take pages of a draft of a manuscript and clip them to a clothesline across his office. Then he'll come back And he'll pick up a pair of binoculars he keeps in his desk drawer. And he'll read them like that to get, you know, perspective. Perspective. Tactical people writers. Now, tactics. Rituals, actually. I think even more than tactics, rituals. Rituals for what? Well, I think rituals to appease the god of fear that Eva talked about. Help us get some writing done. Isabel Allende, the novelist, lights candles for dead relatives before every writing session. Jack Kerouac, the novelist, used to light candles and then get down on his knees in prayer before every writing session. Please, please let me get some writing done. Rituals. Appease the gods of fear. I think the favorite ritual, the favorite tactic of writers is simply procrastination. E.B. White, one of my favorite commentators on writing, once said, "Delay is natural to a writer. I walk around straightening pictures on the wall, rugs on the floor, as though not until everything in the world was lined up and perfectly true could anybody reasonably expect me to put a word down on paper." Does that sound familiar? I call this the as soon as syndrome. I don't call it that. Mary Higgins Clark calls it that. The as soon as syndrome. And I'm going to need your help here. I'm going to need your help at different points in my presentation, because I'm going to throw out some questions and some fill in the blanks. And here's one. As soon as fill in the blank, I'm going to get some writing done. The house is dust free. Perfect. It never will be. That's great. Yeah. Scoop out the horse stall. I love it. I've never heard that one before. Sometimes you might wonder whether you, or I might wonder whether what I'm scooping is that different from what I'm writing. But check all the email. God, what would we do without email as far as keeping us from getting our writing done? It's perfect. And also, it kind of feels like writing. So yeah, I'm almost right. I'm on my way now. I got 10 emails done. I'll be writing in a few minutes. Was there something down here?
Have a cup of coffee.
How can you write without a cup of coffee? Or two or three? Yeah.
As soon as my office is organized.
Well, E.B. White, hey, you know, he would understand. I understand. Yeah, I mean, that my office is never organized, so that's perfect. Yeah.
I said that this very thing this morning. Mm-hmm. As soon as my daughter is married, my granddaughter is shipped off to sea, and I retire, I will write that book.
Perfect. That has to be one of the best I've ever heard. That book will never get written. Yeah. I'm sorry, as soon as my children fall asleep. Well, you parents understand. You know, children never fall asleep. Yeah. Yeah.
As soon as I finish my income taxes.
Well, that one, you have to be careful. That can only come around once a year, so you're going to have to come up with others the rest of the time. Yeah.
As soon as the muse hits me.
Right. But, you know, the muse is a flirt, and the muse is a cheat, and I find the muse sometimes shows up and often stands me up. Yeah. You have only one computer for several people? That's a good one. Yeah.
As soon as I get permission from my family.
You'll never get it. You might write about them if you give them permission. If they give you permission. Yeah.
As soon as I get undressed.
Oh, now we're talking. Now we're back to you're in the bathrobe school. Right. So, as soon as, one more, and then let's get back to this.
One game of computer solitaire.
One game.
Yeah.
Now tell me this, has anyone ever only played one game of computer solitaire? I love it. Okay, as soon as. Approach avoidance. The psychologists call it approach avoidance. We want to write. If you're here, I assume you want to write. Many of us want desperately to write, but we're scared. Approach avoidance. We're scared. We want to write. We're scared to write. And that's okay. I think that goes along with the territory of writing. I think fear is not necessarily a bad thing. I think fear is where writing begins. Good writing, anyway. I think fear and writing go hand in hand. I don't think one could exist without the other. Now, you may be sitting there thinking, I am such a wimp. No one could be as scared as I am about facing this blank piece of paper. Wrong. Wrong, wrong, wrong. Page fright. Page fright. It's universal. You cannot write without page fright. Everybody feels page fright. Let me read you from The Courage to Write what some authors you may have heard of have had to say on this topic. Gabriel Garcia Marquez. All my life I've been frightened at the moment I sit down to write. Margaret Atwood. Blank pages inspire me with terror. John Steinbeck. I suffer as always from the fear of putting down the first line. It is amazing the terrors, the magics, the prayers, the straightening shyness that assails one. John Steinbeck, the Nobel Prize writer. And finally, my favorite, Fran Lebowitz, the essayist. It's really scary just getting to the desk. We're talking now 5 hours. My mouth gets dry, my heart beats fast. I react psychologically the way other people react when the plane loses an engine. So if the idea of writing makes you anxious, you are in good company. Nobel Prize winners. Lots of it. I'm affiliated with a group called the Antioch Writers Workshop in Ohio. Excuse me, Sue Grafton joined us 1 year. And she told us, I guarantee you, and this is Sue Grafton, this incidentally was the very week that her latest Kinsey Mahome mystery novel shot to the top of the New York Times bestseller list after 1 week in the market. Sue Grafton said, I guarantee you that every day I sit at my desk, I am scared to death. Grafton said, I hear voices saying, you are such a putz. You're going to get that sentence wrong. And then she did a little routine where she said, where she did Big Sue and Little Sue. And Big Sue would say, well, time to get some writing. And Little Sue would say, I don't want to. And Big Sue would say, well, what do you want to do? Well, I just want to sit here and play with these pencils. Sue Grafton, ladies and gentlemen, number one best-selling author, scared to death. Anxiety is the natural habitat of the writer. In The Courage to Write, I went so far as to say, if you're not scared, you're not writing anything of consequence. And that's why writing takes courage. If we had to say what writing is, Cynthia Ozick, the novelist, once said, we would have to define it essentially as an act of courage. Now, when I became a writer 34 years ago, I didn't realize that anxiety was part of the job description. Then I began to have the sleepless nights. I'd get up in the middle of the night and write notes on paper. Oh, this'll do it. Yeah. Brilliant insight. Well, you know, it's like stuff you write down when you're high, you get up the next day and sounded good at the time. Gibberish. My stomach's in an uproar. I would work, you know, 10 hours a day, 12 hours a day. Maybe if I work another hour, I'll get over all this anxiety I'm feeling, this stress, this tension. I was so scared. A friend of mine offered me, saw me and said, you look tense. I said, tense? Me? No, I'm not tense. Why do you say I'm tense? And she said, how about a massage? I'll give you a relaxing massage. I said, no. Well, why not? I got to get my book done. She said, but it'll get you relaxed. If I get too relaxed, I might not finish my book. Why? What is it that makes writing such an anxious affair? And how can we find the courage to write despite our fears? And I said, please bear in mind, I say despite our fears, not because we have no fears, despite our fears. And because courage, remember, is not the lack of fear, it's the ability to function in the face of fear. General Omar Bradley gave to me what is the best definition of all of courage, which is the capacity to form properly even when scared half to death. So if you're thinking, as soon as I stop being so scared, I'll get some writing done, forget it. You won't. You never will. You'll always be scared. Write anyway. That's what courage is all about. Resistance to fear, Mark Twain called it. Mastery of fear, not the absence of fear. Now, in my experience, a lack of courage has derailed far more writers than a lack of talent. By this I mean an inability to confront, comprehend, and transcend the normal fears that accompany writing. Such fears are common, they're routine even, but they're seldom conscious. We usually confront more of a vague, oh, I'm anxious kind of feeling when we sit down to write more than a set of conscious specific fears. We sit down and we think, I wonder why I'm so tense. I wonder if I'll be able to loosen up enough to get some writing done. And then you go, I wonder what's on television. And then we loosen up. When it comes to writing, it's our unconscious fears that sabotage us every time. My premise is that when we make our unconscious fears conscious, we're better poised to deal with them. It's only after we put a label on our fears that we can get a handle on them. Now, we're getting into some tougher territory now. More demanding questions. And I invite you to reflect silently to yourself on these questions I'm going to throw out at you. Or share some responses if you'd like. Help me out. Now, I'm a former encounter group leader, so I'm comfortable with difficult answers. I'm also a birthright Quaker, and I'm very comfortable with silence. So if you'd rather give me an answer, I'd love to get it. If you'd rather be silent, that's okay too. Okay, here's a question. Here's another fill in the blank. What scares me most about writing is rejection. God. Excuse me?
Dying before it gets done.
And with all the great procrastination ideas, that could happen. Yeah.
Revealing myself.
I'm going to get to that, yeah.
Success.
Could you elaborate? Why does that scare you? Success.
Because then it really exposes you.
So these two tie together. Yeah.
That it's not good enough.
God, how could, it's never, you know, I'm going to get to that too. It's never good enough.
Having no new ideas.
Drying up.
Making mistakes.
My feeling is if you're not, I have a book out called Whoever Makes the Most Mistakes Wins.
Taking too long.
And with all the great procrastination suggestions, that could happen.
What scares me is that if I do all this work and then all of a sudden I keel over and die and then my sons walk off to the dumpster with a whole...
I don't even want to think about that one. I've given my kids... I'm a great saver and collector. I have dozens and dozens of file drawers full of old research notes and news clippings and so on and so forth. And I've given my kids permission to put it all to the torch if that's what they want, but not my manuscripts. They have to save my manuscripts. Any one more, and then let me, yeah.
Rewriting.
That's good. You know, a lot of people can't write because, not that they can't write, they can't rewrite. And rewriting is the essence of writing. Now, okay, the most common response I find to this question of, you know, what scares you most about writing is that I can't pull it off. That I can't pull it off. I mean, here I've told the world and all that I'm a writer. Maybe I even signed a contract, and we're about to find out, aren't we? Even experienced writers plague themselves with that doubt. Anthony Burgess, who wrote over 50 novels in a very prolific career, even in his 70s, Anthony Burgess said he thought constantly from quitting from fear that his work was simply not good enough. Who was it over here said that was their concern? Yeah. You have good company, Anthony Burgess. Doubts about meeting their own standards are routine among working writers, which doesn't stop them from writing. One of my favorite comments about book writing was from the late novelist Iris Murdoch, who said, "Every book is the wreck of a perfect idea." But is that so bad? Is that so bad? I mean, let's hear what William Faulkner, another Nobel Prize winner, had to say on this topic. "All of us failed to meet our dream of perfection," said Faulkner. "So I rate us on the basis of our splendid failure to do the impossible. In my opinion, if I could write all my work again, I'm convinced that I would do it better, which is the healthiest condition for an artist. That's why he keeps on working, trying again. He believes each time that this time he will do it. Bring it off. Of course he won't." Which is why this condition is healthy. Once he did it, once he matched the work to the image, the dream, nothing would remain but to cut his throat and jump off the other side of that pinnacle of perfection into suicide. What? That was why there was all the plant moving before. Fear of plants. So, if like Faulkner and so many others who have repeated that sentiment, you have found a way to forge ahead and you plan to write despite your doubts, the next question is, what about? What I'd most like to write about is. Now, that sounds simple enough. I'm not even going to, you know. I'd like to write about houseplants. Or, you know, I'd like to write about cordless microphones. Or I'd like to write about the history of Whidbey Island. Sounds simple. You know, ideas are all about. But it isn't. Because what we most want to write about can be touchy. Self-revealing, embarrassing. In fact, if it's a good idea, it probably will be. I couldn't write about that. But that is what readers most want to read about. So think about that. I couldn't write about that. Think about that. Arthur Miller said the best work that anybody ever writes is the work that is on the verge of embarrassing him always. Let me tell you about the experience I had with my most commercially successful book, which is There Life After High School? Now, this book came about because one day I went down to my mailbox, brought back an envelope that set up in the left corner, CHS Class of 62. Yeah. Ooh, right. You know where I'm headed. This was in 72. So, I brought it into my house. I opened up the envelope. I started to read. The Champaign Senior High School Class of 62 invites you to your 10th year. And all of a sudden, the paper started trembling. Now, why was the paper trembling? It wasn't defective paper, it's that my hands were trembling. Why were my hands trembling? My God, did I, 10 years out, I still remembered those people very vividly. And I wasn't sure, did I want to go back and give them another shot at me? Now that's, I was 28 years old. I'd had a couple of books out. I was doing pretty well. I'd been married for a few years. And, but there I was. I could have been 15 years old reading this reunion announcement. It was very embarrassing to realize how little I had matured in all those years, which wasn't much at all. So, I got myself together, started talking to other people. Do you have memories of high school? What are they like? Were you a cheerleader? Was I a cheerleader? What a question to ask me. Do I look like a cheerleader type? That's from ex-cheerleaders. They hate that question. Were you popular? No, I wasn't popular. Do you really hate me? Why are you trying to hurt me? High school memories are very intense, very vivid, at all ends of the spectrum. But you know what was... So I ended up, getting a contract to write a book about high school memories, and as part of that, I didn't go to my reunion, which was too scary by half. But I did go back to my high school. And I walked in the main hallway, found that my feet remembered to avoid the brass CHS plaque. You don't want to do that. Made my way to the gym where Coach Kabuti was still there, the guy who had cut me from the freshman team because he didn't think I was good enough. He was right, but got myself out there on the floor, with shooting jumpers better than I used to shoot, hoping Coach Kabuti would notice. And I went over and introduced myself, and he said, "Oh yeah, guys, yeah, I think I remember. What'd you say your name was again?" And then the lunch bell rang, and like any good Pavlovian dog, I thought, "Oh, lunch! I'm hungry." So I dashed to the cafeteria, got in line, went through, got meatloaf, gravy, cooked green beans, very cooked. Roll, two rolls, please. Butter, two pats of butter, please. I walked off the line. Oh, I forgot dessert, peach cobbler. And then I stood there at the end of the line, and I thought, where am I going to sit? I wonder who wants me at their table. Probably no one. Oh, I'll go over, sit over there. But they'll tell me to go away. Oh, my God, what am I going to... And then, just like a dream, this little voice behind me from a girl I've been chatting with in line says, "If you're not sitting with anybody, you could come sit with me and Beth." And I turned around and said, "Well, thank you. Thank you. So, yes, I would like to sit with you and Beth." Embarrassing? God! Did I say 15? Try 14? I mean, it was one of the most humiliating days of my life. And yet from that experience grew some writing, a book that is still one of my favorite because it cut very close to my obsessions. I was writing there about that I didn't want people to know about me, that I was still so hung up on high school. And yet, because it turned out so many other people were, so many other readers, that was the book that touched a nerve. Because that, I was working very close to my embarrassments there, my sense of humiliation. So, best work, on the verge of embarrassing you always. But consider the consequences of writing about that, about, touchy topics. I wonder if Mom will think I did some field research for the sex scenes. I wonder how my kids will react to the plot line about parents getting a divorce. I wonder how my Uncle Horace the cop will feel about that very authentic sounding shoplifting scene. I wonder what's on television. So you see what we're dealing with here. You see what we're up against. You begin to see not just that we're scared, but why we're scared. How could we not be scared? A few years ago, I put together a collection of essays by guys about their dads, sons and fathers. And the genesis of this was I had read so many extremely touching essays by men about their fathers. It was like this topic was too important not to tell the truth about. And it was very hard. It was a that topic. And because of that, the writing just tended to be very spare, very direct, very honest, very touching. But most of them were eulogies. And at the end of these eulogies, invariably, there would be a line, "I never told my father any of this. I wish I had him back even for a minute so I could tell him in person what I'm writing you now." Now, my dad was still alive when this came out. And I felt to keep faith with the contributors, I, in my introduction, had to write about him, even though I knew he would read it. And yet I felt to keep faith with the other guys, I had to try to be as honest as they were, knowing he would read that. And I also knew that I would have to send it to him before it was published, because I didn't want him reading it in print. This is just the very beginning of what I wrote. Like so many fathers in the 1950s, mine lived on the outskirts of our family. He worked a lot, traveled at times, and didn't have much to say when he was home. Mom was the garrulous parent. She discussed our day, put band-aids on our cuts, and lavished praise on our finger painting. During the summer, Dad would occasionally dig out a flat old baseball glove and play catch with his three sons. Sometimes he'd drive us all to the beach. When we were little, my two brothers and I once took turns tickling my father as he dozed on the sofa. Without opening his eyes, Dad made a game of trying to catch us with a swooping hand as we screamed and giggled and dashed out of reach. But that sort of thing is rare in my memory. I just don't remember a whole lot about Dad during my childhood. To me, he felt present, but not accounted for. This wasn't what I had in mind for a father. What I had in mind was a guy who took up more space, someone who could hit home runs, stare down the bad guys, handy with a hammer, handy with his fists. At an age when bullies were picking on me, I wanted a model, someone to imitate when it came time to stick up for myself. I'd been hoping for Superman, but I had to settle for Clark Kent. It gets worse. But it gets better, too. It was a mixed review. You know, I think like any one of us could write about a parent. And it leads to the next question, the next fear. What will people think of me when they read what I write? But, you know, it's not usually just people. We say, well, oh, my God, what are people going to think of me? What are people going to think? But it's not people. It's persons, specific persons. I remember once watching a first novelist at a bookstore in Dayton, Ohio, about to go on to give a presentation at a book signing. And she looked out at the audience, and I could overhear her saying to a friend of hers, "Oh my God, this is so much tougher than New York." And the friend said, "Excuse me, Dayton, Ohio, tougher than New York City? Just what do you mean?" And the novelist said, "I didn't know anyone in New York." She said, "That was a piece of cake. Look out here. There's my aunt. There's my cousin. There's my nephew. There's my mother. Oh, God." Persons. Specific persons. Comedians, stand-up comedians have often told me the toughest audience is not the drunks who throw bottles at you. It's the one that has relatives. And whenever we write and publish, our audience has relatives and friends and classmates and neighbors. So think about this. The person whose reaction to my writing most concerns me is a relative, a spouse, kids, an old teacher, your next-door neighbor, your Aunt Emily in Omaha. Anybody have any others? Or confirm any of those?
My daughter.
Your daughter. That's a tough one. Ah, smart thinking. Yeah.
Does it help to have a pen name?
That's a good question. Does it help to have a pen name? Can you sit on that? If we have time afterwards, I'd like to address that. I hope maybe we'll have a little time. My quick answer is, in the short run it helps, but in the long run I think it hurts because it just kind of sidesteps the question of facing your fears. Anyone else? Person scares you? Yeah. Way back there.
An old flame.
An old flame. Yeah.
How about your spouse?
Spouse. Big one. Tough one. It's not easy being married to a writer. Think about it. Not easy being married if you are a writer. You notice how often our best writers get divorced in a serial set. I mean, what's Norman Mailer had? About 5 wives? There's a reason. Anyone else? Person you're most concerned about? Yeah.
My son, the attorney.
Your son, the attorney. You worried he's going to sue you? Now, whoever's opinion most concerns you, that's your censor-in-chief. And we all have them. It's usually a parent. John Fowles rewrote The Magus, the novel The Magus, years after it had first come out, and punched up the sex scenes. Somebody asked him why he did that, and he said, well, I couldn't have done it until my parents died. He referred to that number one horror for every writer, the dear them, your mom and dad. One guy I talked to, a guy came to interview me for the 700 Club, which was a story in itself, but I'll forego that story. Anyway, as this happens a lot, the camera is shut down. He says, you know, I've been doing some writing. I said, yeah. He said, yeah, but I'm kind of blocked. I said, why? He said, well, I got halfway through a novel and I made the mistake of mentioning to my mother that I was in the middle of a novel. And she said, well, could I have a look at it? And he said, well, no, Mom, come on. It's really half-baked. It's just it's a really rough draft. Let me finish it and polish it up first. She said, well, let me be the judge of that. Oh, that's right. So I said, so where's that novel? He said, in the bottom drawer of my desk, pushed way to the back. Censors in chief. Now, some say the opinions of others are of no real concern to a real writer. You know, they don't care. Annie Dillard says you should write as if you're dying. Nadine Gordimer says you should write as if you're already dead. Hey, who cares? Let them talk. I don't agree. And I don't agree for sort of almost, I don't know, I hate to use this word, almost like ethical reasons. I mean, yeah, we're writers, but we're human beings too. And even accomplished writers tend to their relations with others. You know, you can't live without being connected to others, and you wouldn't want to. Isabel Allende, when she's told a story by someone that she'd like to integrate into her writing, she, even though it's fiction, she always asks permission first. Do you think anyone's ever denied her permission? When I sent my dad the essay I wrote about him for Sons and Fathers in manuscript form, talk about stiff. I just walked around on pins and needles for days. This was back in the snail mail era, waiting to hear from him. 3 days later, the phone rings. I pick it up, and this old guy's voice is, Ralph? And I say, yeah. I said, this is Dad. And I say, yes. And I love it. I love it. I love what you wrote about me. He said, I am so honored. And then he said, but what took you so long? He said, I've been dropping pearls for years hoping. You never know. We usually find that, you know, the opinion of others is less of a problem than we expect, because much of our concern about them and their opinion of us is really a projection of our own fears. Their opinion of us isn't so much what we're concerned about as our opinion of us as reflected back. I once talked to a trumpeter named Bill Berry, who told me early in his career he had learned a lot of his licks from Dizzy Gillespie. And he went out once during a concert, and he went up to the front of the stage to do a solo, kind of a Dizzy Gillespie knockoff. And he was about to start in, and just right about there was Dizzy Gillespie. And he goes, And then after the concert, he went up and shook hands with Gillespie, and he said, hey, you know, sorry about using some of your licks there. I hope you didn't mind. And Gillespie said, mine? He said, I was flattered. He said, we all take from each other. That's what it's all about. And Barry said, all these years I had been worried Gillespie might hear me someday and get furious. He said, and it turned out it wasn't his problem, it was my problem. You know, I was worried about how well I was doing as a trumpeter. That was the real issue. And that's the real issue in writing. And so that leads us to the most basic fear of all. What might we reveal about ourself in our writing, as you mentioned earlier? Now here's a fill in the blank. What I'm most afraid people will find out about me through my writing is. And I think let's go into deep Quaker mode here. I think that's a good one to reflect on silently. It's a harrowing question. A friend of mine who's a writer said, there are things I don't necessarily want to reveal to myself, let alone to others. Like it or not, the words we write will bring us nose to nose with ourselves. Do you ever find your pen running away with you? Nathaniel Hawthorne said, the devil himself gets into my inkstand. I think that's why writing demands so much courage. Herman Melville said the writers he admired most were the ones he called divers. The ones who went deepest into themselves and brought back the shiniest pearls. And as that term suggests, writing is both daunting and exhilarating. One of the metaphors authors like most about themselves is that of the explorer, setting off, not knowing exactly where they're going, scared of the journey, but excited, exhilarated, up for the trip. You can't separate the excitement of writing from the fear of writing. Excitement is the flip side of fear. Kids knew that. You know, do you remember when you were six? Scare me, Daddy. Scare me. Come on. Throw me up. Real high this time. Real high. Scare me, Daddy. Scare me. We knew that when we were six, but, you know, we get older. We turn things down a little bit. We make a deal. You know, if I won't be so scared all the time, maybe I won't feel anything too much all the time. And how about that? Writers don't have that option. Writers have to tune it up. Writers have to go into their fears. That's why E.B. White once said, I admire anyone who has the guts to write anything at all. I do too. And that's why I feel I'm in the company of some gutsy people today. People who are embarking on a bold journey from a good port. A real port in this case. I love it. After she attended a writer's workshop some 40 years ago, Anne Sexton, the poet, was asked, what can you expect to gain from a workshop? And Sexton replied, why, courage, of course. And more than anything else, that's what I hope you take home from this weekend. And I know you will. The courage to write. Thank you. Thank you.